Welcome to Guerrilla Radio on CFUV 101.9 FM, 104.3 on your cable dial. And, you know, we're heard around the world at cfuv.uvic.ca in Shoutcast. Well, as the old saying goes, never were so many killed that dug their graves with a knife and fork. It's a saw as true today as when coined back in the 17th century, but that's where similarities end. The food systems most of us in North America depend on today would be entirely unrecognizable to the gout-plagued forebears in Europe, and largely alien even to contemporary first-generation Canadians coming from agrarian societies. Today, the sheer size, scope, and complexities involved in getting your dinner to your plate would boggle the minds of mere diners, at least it would if given a second thought. As with so much in our modern life, even the most basic functions required to sustain life, like eating, has become something we need expert help in understanding. John Steinman is a Nelson, BC-based writer, broadcaster, and creator of CJLY's award-winning radio program, Deconstructing Dinner. That's carried here at CFUV every Thursday afternoon at 1 p.m., by the way. And Steinman warns of the serious consequences of our dietary lifestyle of convenience. Consequences already coming home to roost in troubling and sometimes terrifying ways. John Steinman and What's on Your Plate in the first half. And even more essential to human survival than food, that we eat is water. Without water, human fragility becomes quickly apparent. We wither and die in a matter of days. Water is the essence of virtually all life on this planet. Amazing, then, the way water is treated in Canada, where every day millions of gallons of fresh water is fouled beyond reclamation to produce oil and grease the wheels of industry. As well as removing irreplaceable water from the hydrological cycle, we also interfere with the natural course of waterways with dam works, routinely destroy wetlands, continue to log trees and watersheds, and fill in delta lands for housing development, all at incalculable cost to the natural environment and its wild inhabitants. Eloise Charest Bear Clan is a longtime peace, justice, and environment activist. She has traveled the world doing good works in dangerous environments, but is only in her native Canada where her efforts for the common goods for people and land rewarded with prison. Eloise Charest Bear Clan still championing the wild in the second segment. And Janine Bancroft will join us at the bottom of the hour to bring us up to speed with all that's good to do in and around Victoria in the coming week. But first, John Steinman and Reconstruct Your Diet. Stick around. Well, welcome to the program, John.
Thanks, Chris. Actually, that mention of reconstructing your diet is—I haven't heard that before—and it's a great—it's a great title that I should maybe start to incorporate, because that seems to be the direction the show's going in.
Well, this is what it's all about, really, isn't it, John? I mean, more than beyond me. I mean, you know, I remember when your program—the first time I heard your program right here at CFUV—and I thought, you know, wow, you know, what a great idea, you know, a show about, you know, what we eat and how we eat. And I know I've talked to many people that focus on these over the years I've done this show, but honestly, I thought, well, you know, that it's a great idea and it could carry for two or three or maybe a four-part series or something. But now you're entering your third year and it seems you've got a lot of ground to cover yet. Now, were you aware just how big this project would be when you undertook it all those years ago, John?
I think I was aware, and I think it was being aware of how big of a subject it really is that really sparked an interest to not only produce a show right here in Nelson, but produce the show in Nelson and get it out onto other radio stations, not just in BC, but in Canada, and now it's out on stations in the U.S. as well. And it's really, I think, because this is a subject that is so huge, it's never really been tackled so much by the media. And I think when you really start to take it apart, you realize that food in and of itself is life. And when we start to take food as a central focus, what we're really doing is, you know, if we're deconstructing it, as I do on my show, we're really deconstructing life itself and how we individually are connecting with the outside world, how we're connecting with people around the planet, how we're connecting with our friends, our family, and most importantly, I think, is a window in how we connect with ourselves, as food is, of course, what we are ingesting to sustain our lives.
Well, of course, they always say, you know, you are what you eat. And if food and what we eat is going to be an analogy to the kind of society that we live in today, well, then, John, what does the Twinkie say to you about us?
what does the Twinkie say? Well, it's funny you bring that up, because I don't know if you've, there is a book out there called Twinkie Deconstructed.
No way.
and it's Steve Ettlinger who wrote that book, and I've been hoping to bring him on to the show, and he actually addressed that very question. And he went and took every ingredient within the Twinkie and laid it out and did a whole chapter on each ingredient, you know, and where that ingredient originated. And what you find is that most of the ingredients in a Twinkie were, in fact, mined out of, you know, open pits in various parts of the United States. So it's funny you bring that question up.
Mined out of open pits? What do you mean? How like it's not actual food? It's minerals that people...
Well, when we look at ingredients like baking soda and baking powder, you start to look at the building blocks of what those really are, and they're from rocks, similar to salt. Salt is a mined ingredient coming from the ground in most cases.
Well, this is exactly it. I mean, you know, I'm pretty ignorant of all this stuff. You know, I'm sort of a regular kind of Joe, although I've been vegetarian for, I don't know, approaching a decade now. But I mean, you know, otherwise, you know, I kind of go to the grocery store and, you know, and I pick something off the shelf and I eat it. It's probably come from a long way away. I'm not really sure. I try to buy organic, but I'm not even sure about that either. You know, I'm trying to be political in a sense in being a vegetarian, because I know how damaging the meat industry is to the environment, and not to mention the cruelty to the animals and everything else. But John, help me out here. I mean, I'm as lost in the aisles as anybody. How do we come to a place where, you know, we know what we're doing when we sit down to buy dinner and make it?
Well, I think it's a really good question, and it's such a large question that really I think that's the foundation for the show. But I think the first step is recognizing that it's not so much about being able to walk into a store and having the most ideal choices laid out for us. I think it involves becoming actually more involved in the process itself, and that means meeting your farmers, meeting the producers, understanding where the food's coming from. And it's at that point where I think we can begin to develop a level of comfort in what it is we're eating, because we know the history behind it. And I think if it's the global system, if it's the more conventional grocery stores that are going to be responding to this rise in interest of eating locally and eating with more of a conscience, it's not going to be satisfied within the grocery store, because the model of the mainstream conventional grocery store is to be able to lay things out very, very easily. You walk through and they've got that Muzak piped in, and you pick your products without even really thinking about it. And I don't think that that's going to be the venue to really become more connected with our food. And it's difficult. And that's what makes it such a big question, because most Canadians are living in urban centers now, and to mm-hmm. really be connected to where the food's coming from is becoming really difficult. And I know for myself, I mean, I can be honest, like I still feel very ignorant when it comes to what it is I'm eating and what it is that's available to me. And the more I dig deeper into this subject, the more I realize how much I don't know. And, you know, there are people who have spent their entire lives trying to figure out what the most ideal diet is for us to eat. And really, when you get down to the very base level of understanding as much as you possibly can, it becomes clear that most of what we're eating can really be questioned in a very critical light.
Well, yeah, well, you know, more than 80% of Canadians live in urban centers now. And 100 years ago, I think it was exactly the opposite, with 80% of Canadians living in what you'd call rural areas. And we're, you know, we're all as ignorant as get out here. But there is change in the wind, right, John? I mean, now, I know the farmers markets, organic produce is getting immensely popular, growing at leaps and bounds every year. You know, right next to my house, there's a Safeway Corporation outlet. And Safeway Canada, as it's called, you go in there, and I do it as rarely as I can. But I went in there the other day, and they've reorganized it. You know, it has a warmer feel to it. It's not just all the fluorescent lights. And they actually had a live musician playing in there. They were doing a fundraising thing. They've got a big expanding organics, although all of this stuff is from the United States. Now, what about the politics of food, John?
Well, I mean, you raise an interesting point in terms of the politics of that. I mean, in that sense, certainly what they're creating is an image of being able to source your food and feel as though you're connected with it, and in creating that warm environment. And I know exactly what you're speaking of, because the same thing happened here at our Safeway here. Mm-hmm. But Safeway is a great example of really addressing the politics. I mean, if you want to talk about the politics of how these businesses are structured, right here in Nelson, we have a huge range of local producers and farmers who have tried to get their products into some of these major grocery store chains here in Nelson. And we happen to be at the halfway point between Calgary and the Lower Mainland, which are the two main hubs of distribution. I think Safeway is coming, most of their products are coming out of Calgary. And for any local producer who wants to get their product into Safeway, they technically would have to send it out to Calgary before it could make its way back into the grocery store right here in Nelson. And if you want to talk politics, I mean, that's one of the greatest barriers for really a local food system to thrive, because here are the major purchasers of food within a community who are shutting out the primary producer, the farmer, or the processor. And I mean, as a contrast, we happen to also have a Save-On food store here, which they've done something that most other Save-Ons, I don't believe, have done, and they've allowed some of these products to come in. And I've spoken with a lot of these processors and farmers who have their products in the Save-On store, and without that, they would not be able to stay in business. They're a major purchaser. There's so much volume that's going through those stores that when we talk about major grocery stores having power, I mean, that is, to me, one of the greatest examples right there.
Well, you know, if I'm understanding this right now, if I was a producer of some sort of agricultural product in or around Nelson, and I did manage to talk Safeway into carrying some of my produce, are you saying then that I'd have to stick it on a truck, send it to Calgary, and then it would be sent back across the Rockies to Nelson?
Exactly, and likely you would have to get that product to Calgary somehow. So, of course, you're eliminating pretty much any small-scale producer who could never even justify that, let alone just the environmental conscience that hopefully most people will have to say, well, I'm not going to allow that to happen, to have my product shipped out that way. And it's not even just with so much the actual product going from the final product from the producer to the retail store. It's even from the farmer. I mean, in the case of eggs, in this region in particular, we don't have I believe it's a provincial or federally inspected grading station. So therefore, anyone who is producing eggs who wants to get their eggs into one of these stores, or any restaurant for that matter, would technically have to send their eggs to the Okanagan, which is at least a 3.5-4 hour drive, to get them graded and then sent back here to be sold. And so it's not just happening between the retail and the producer, but it's even happening between, you know, the chicken farmer and even trying to get it into restaurants as well.
Well, these are controlled markets, and dairy is another thing. Well, if you've just tuned in, you're listening to Guerrilla Radio on CFUV 101.9 FM in Victoria, 104.3 on our cable system, and we're heard around the world at cfuv.uvic.ca and Shoutcast everywhere else. I'm speaking tonight with John Steinman, and John is the producer and host of Deconstructing Dinner, which you can hear right here at CFUV every Thursday at 1 p.m. And it's all over the other, everywhere else. What's the word for that? You're syndicated
yeah,
everywhere else. That's really interesting, John, when you talk about the environment of transporting, you know, the environmental damage caused by, you know, trucking these things millions of miles, you know, to get onto your plate. But now we're getting into the area, which has become very popular in the last year, of growing food directly to fuel those vehicles in the form of biodiesel. What about that, John? You covered this angle on your show as well, I'm sure.
Yeah, well, I did cover the biofuel issue back in November on a two-part series, and it really is one of the, I think, the most important topics that needs to be addressed. And certainly, the mainstream media has somewhat just glanced the other way. And what we're talking about here is taking up land to grow fuel, and taking that away from the possibility of growing crops for food. And this isn't a process to replace oil, and that needs to be stressed, that when you start to look at the energy balance between what fuels our food system today and what fuels pretty much our entire industrial world, the energy balance of oil is a pretty good energy balance. It's a very rich resource. When you look at biofuels, you're not talking about a very good energy balance here. And energy balance, what I mean is how much energy you put in versus how much energy you get out. And so in terms of oil, I think right now oil, you put in one barrel of oil to get 20 barrels out, And in the case of something like ethanol, you're putting in one barrel of oil to get two barrels of ethanol out. It's not a replacement, and really what it's doing is sort of subsidizing the transition, which is more expensive oil, and it's just going to basically delay the inevitable, which is oil getting to be $200 a barrel maybe, or of course oil perhaps running out. And when we talk about biofuels, I mean, the biggest travesty, I think, is the way they're being painted, the way they're being marketed. And one thing that I know I outlined on the show and really stressed is how the body within Canada that is the trade association representing all of the biofuel manufacturers and a lot of agricultural companies that have something to gain from this industry. The industry is called the Canadian Renewable Fuels Association, and their website is even called greenfuels.org, and it paints this very green image. But when you start to, of course, take apart where these biofuels are coming from and how they're produced, you're technically looking at a renewable crop, but it's not necessarily sustainable. And that was the real message that came out of there, because of course what's going into growing some of these major agricultural crops that are now being converted into fuel, and we're talking corn, soy, canola, palm oil, sugarcane, these crops all require incredible amounts of fertilizers to be grown on these massive monocultures, incredible amounts of pesticides. Most of them are genetically modified, which raises a whole other slew of questions and concerns. And when you start to really look at it and you take it apart and you literally deconstruct it, you see that, well, this is not a good thing. And I don't even know if it can be argued to be better. I mean, it hasn't really been, I don't think, researched enough to really say, okay, let's lay everything out on the table here and what exactly are we doing? And that I don't think has happened. It's been a very quick, let's jump on this bandwagon. This is the next big thing. And the amount of money that's going into biofuels right now is astronomical. I mean, Stephen Harper announced $1.5 billion to help the industry get off the ground. And that was back in June or July.
Well, and of course George Bush has jumped on this too. And so when George Bush jumps on something, you know it's got to be evil. But I mean, John, I mean, these guys have also hijacked. I mean, biodiesel. Now I've got a friend here, Kenji, friend of the show. He's over the last few years, he's formed a coalition of people to get into biofuel, but they use, you know, the downstream product from restaurants in the form of edible food oils, you know, and they called that biodiesel. But now this new biodiesel, which is not come downstream of edible, you know, like the grease out of McDonald's or whatever else. It's, you know, food is grown, or palm, this palm oil thing is a disaster in the Pacific, I understand, as well, right?
It is. And I would say that differentiation between using recycled oil from, say, the back of a restaurant versus the crops being grown specifically for the purpose of fueling them into your car so you can go to the movie theater, that it's too bad that there's the same name being attached to both of those.
Well, is that a coincidence?
What's that?
Do you think that's a coincidence?
Well, I mean, technically they're all, I guess you can say, biofuels. I mean, I don't even know what biofuel means, but I mean, it's the same concept. It's oil derived from vegetable crops. And it's just the industry has kind of grown so quickly, so fast, that there hasn't been enough time to really start to differentiate between what all of these biofuels are. And I think some of these smaller producers, such as Kenji, who is instead using recycled oils, that it would almost be better to rebrand what that name is, because it is a completely different product coming from a completely different source. But with that said, I haven't done enough research into the recycled oil side of biofuels to really know whether there really is enough oil out there to sort of fuel the sort of system we have right now.
Well, but billions served, you know.
This is true. Maybe for every quarter pounder, you can fuel a car.
But at the restaurant. I mean, why go to a gas station? You could just. And I'm getting silly now. Well, John, you've done one of the shows that really bothered me. Now, one of this, I mean, of course, with the biofuels, just one word for that is topsoil. But the going on, corn. Now, my grandfather was an Englishman. He came to Canada from Britain. he would never eat corn. He says, no, corn is for pigs. You know, it's fodder. You don't, you know, humans aren't supposed to eat corn. That was his position. Well, fine. But now humans are eating corn in a way that they might not even realize that they're eating. What about this whole business of corn and what it's doing to the North American diet and the people that are eating it?
Well, I would say Michael Pollan probably took that apart best in The Omnivore's Dilemma, where he spent a whole chapter pretty much laying out how corn makes its way into every ingredient within the processed food system, that is. And I think it's when we're talking about corn making its way into our diets, we're really referring to the processed food that is consumed. And I think one of the greatest changes that's taken place is the introduction of high fructose corn syrup, HFCS, which is derived from a very intensive, very energy intensive process of wet milling, which is what the process is called, and this product is so much cheaper than sugar that it's making its way into pretty much almost every product that has anything that has a sugar substance within it, in particular soft drinks. You know, soft drinks I don't believe have had sugar in them since at least the 80s. And you have now that replaced with high fructose corn syrup. And what that's allowed is for a lot of these manufacturers to justify putting in copious amounts of this stuff into all food, and instead of using sugar, using this high fructose corn syrup. So in a sense, by creating this very energy-intensive process of taking corn and converting it into a liquid sugar, high fructose corn syrup, they've been able to expand the power of the industrial food system far beyond what they could have done, I think, if only sugar was available, which is a far more expensive ingredient. And so corn has had a significant impact on, you know, if you want to start really deconstructing it, it's had a significant impact on destroying the ability for small-scale restaurants to exist alongside the more conventional fast food restaurants that are really taking advantage of this very, very cheap ingredient making its way into the food system.
Well, yeah, and not to mention the diabetes epidemic that we're seeing in North America, and which is spreading everywhere, that this North American style diet tends to go. And this is a soda pop. Don't drink that shit. I mean, really, please, people, don't drink it. It's terrible. Well, John, we're fast running out of time, but I know in your last show, and in you're doing a series now where you're talking about genetically modified organisms. Now, Percy Schmeiser's been on this show a couple times, and he recently won the Right Livelihood Award. I'm pleased to say, what about this? What about Canada and GMO, John? In a thumbnail.
Well, we could quickly talk about Percy then. I mean, Percy, I was just talking with him on the phone a couple days ago, just not on the air, but he had just gotten back from a whirlwind tour in Germany, speaking about these issues to farmers there, and they don't have genetically engineered crops yet in Germany, and certainly what's happening in France has also been making the news as well. And so he's come back to a court case. I mean, he's going after Monsanto again, and instead of this being a large sum of money, he's actually going into small claims court. And what he's doing is he's seeking $600 that 2 years ago he had to fork out to bring some contractors onto his property to remove Monsanto's genetically engineered variety of canola that had contaminated his field. And he hired these contractors to come and take the crops out. That cost him $600, and now he's taking Monsanto to court to pay back that $600. And this is a precedent-setting case, and this is actually going to court, which is quite exciting. And it's a precedent-setting case because what this case may conclude is that companies like Monsanto, who now have ownership over plants, now have to maintain the responsibility of the damage that their property is now causing.
Well, this is an amazing thing. And when I talked to Percy, I said, hey, Percy, I think that the gist of your case is genetic pollution. And, you know, Monsanto was saying that, you know, our crops won't spread. You know, our genetically modified seeds, canola in this case, won't spread. And, of course, Percy is an organic farmer, so they've ruined his certification by, you know, polluting his field. But he thought at the time, no, the lawyers didn't want to go that way. They wanted to go another way. But now it's interesting to see that he's coming back to this genetic pollution and saying, okay, Monsanto, you got the patent on this form of life. Now you got to control Frankenstein.
Mm-hmm. Exactly. And I think what we're also seeing now, too, is not only what's happening within our borders, but there was a really nice article that appeared on the Taiyi I believe it was today, referencing now what Canada is doing outside of our borders. And in this case, they're starting to pressure the European Union to begin to accept genetically engineered crops and genetically engineered foods. And I think, as many people know, the European Union has long had mandatory labeling of genetically engineered crops. And this has literally kept the stuff off of the shelves.
Well, it's ruined the canola farmers here in Canada because of the high degree of GMO canola. Now they're trying to get wheat. Well, John, you see, this is the problem. Now, this is much too broad a topic. I know, for one thing, you've got a new affiliation with the TYEE. That's the TYEE, TYEE.ca. That's a BC-based news website, very good site. And your show, as I mentioned, is 1 o'clock here every Thursday afternoon. And what else, John? How do you recommend people that want to find out more about deconstructing dinner? And I really urge everybody, it's not just about food, believe me. How do they go about finding out more, John?
Well, the website for Deconstructing Dinner has really been set up to be as concentrated of a resource as possible, and I believe right now it's probably one of the most concentrated resources of information on these topics that's out there. And each show, it's not just the archived broadcast that gets posted. It's all of the resources that I've gone through as I've done my research, and all of the links to the organizations and references that pop up within a broadcast. And I encourage anybody to go to the website, which is cjly.net/deconstructingdinner, or you can just Google a Deconstructing Dinner search and go and explore the website and subscribe to the podcast if you have an iPod or an MP3 player. And certainly, you could spend probably a couple of years on that site and never get bored, I would suggest.
Well, it's a fantastic show, and I'm glad to see that you're getting so much success from it, John. And again, it's here at 1 p.m. every Thursday's Deconstructing Dinner. And do check it out, and if you're computer capable. Once again, John, the site?
cjly.net/deconstructingdinner.
CJLY. Okay, thanks a lot, John, for coming on, and keep up the great work, eh?
Thanks for the opportunity, Chris.
Well, my great pleasure. Now, I want you guys to stick around. I'm going to be joined by Janine in just a minute, and she's going to bring us up to speed with some of the groovy things going on in and around Victoria in the coming weeks, so do stick around.
Support CFUV and enter to win a prize worth $100. All you have to do is visit cfuv.ca, follow the link under online research study, and take a short online survey for the UVic Psychology Department. $5 will be donated to CFUV for each person who completes the survey, and participants will be entered into a draw to win either $100 cash or a $100 gift certificate to the UVic bookstore. The survey has been approved by the UVic Human Research Ethics Board.
Yo, this is Mastercraft. You're listening to CFUV 101.9 FM in Victoria, broadcast in stereo.
Oh, welcome back to Gorilla Radio, CFUV 101.9 FM, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. Joining us now, as often as she does, is Janine Bancroft. Hey, Janine.
Et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, Chris.
Well, you know, how many times?
Yeah, I know. And we wonder if people actually tune in. Do you think they do? Do they change that dial around and go, oh, what's this radio station? This sounds good.
Well, yeah, I used to. Before I just came only to CFUV, I used to cruise the radio dial for sure, and especially when there's so much crap on there. It's awful.
The commercials are annoying.
Sure. And the music, well, anyway.
And speaking of the corporatization of everything, isn't Jimmy Pattison on Save on Food?
Indeed, yeah.
And so that's, and he also owns like a big car manufacturing thing.
Well, no, car dealership. Yeah,
dealership.
He owns dealerships all over. Oh, yeah, he's got his fingers in a lot of pies. That guy does.
And a lot of the billboards, right?
Yeah,
for advertising.
Yeah, he's in the bus depots or bus shelters and all that kind of stuff. Yeah, that's a big thing for him too. Yeah.
Aren't bus shelters owned by municipalities?
Well, the buses, too, have advertising on them, right?
Right.
So, I mean, you know, this is a common thing that's been going on, right? Is, you know, you're sticking ads on, you know, anywhere to generate revenues, and it seems, you know, there
you go. I think we should focus more on advertising. You know, we don't do enough of that. We're just out here doing our work, and we need to advertise it more.
Work, that's all I ever do.
Well, if anybody's listening, speaking of food and other things, the Food Not Bombs was at the courthouse today for the rally for the right to sleep trial, which has been delayed again.
This is David Johnston, who I saw today walking around downtown.
Yeah, well, it's not just David, but I mean, he was the, sort of the catalyst for the court case, and there was a fair crowd, I have to say, and a number of media, so it might be on. I noticed the Czech guys were there, so it might be on, or Che, or whatever it is these days, it might be on the corporate media there. And tonight there's a couple of interesting things. If you're interested in democracy, there's the Fernwood Wisdom Council info meeting. So the Wisdom Council is where they choose 12 random people. They just put their finger in the phone book and phone people up, apparently. And they get them together, and they get them to come up with their own topic of interest, whatever is of interest to the whole group, and then they sit around and talk about it, and they have to come up with a statement that everybody can agree on. And so it's just, it's an exercise in democracy, you know? And anyways, if people are interested, I think they can just go tonight at 7 o'clock at the Fernwood Inn. Always a good place for democracy at the pub.
Oh, yeah.
Or, here's another interesting, important thing, is out at Souk, you know, all that farmland, or, sorry, not farmland, but the Western Forest Products forest lands were taken out of the tree farm license. So this includes, like, the Souk Hills and everything, and it could potentially be sold off to developers, right?
One of the plots that they'd already put the roadwork in, you know, before getting any kind of going, you know, doing anything officially, and this has been a bit of an embarrassment. You know, these guys just sort of, you know, stampeded ahead, and this is thanks to Rich Coleman, the provincial government fellow, who this is his kind of line of work. Yeah, this is out by Shirley and Jordan River.
Yeah, serious business. So another exercise in democracy is happening at the Otter Point Fire Hall at Souk at 7 o'clock, if anybody's interested. I also got an email today. Apparently they're in the tree set again today.
Who's that then?
The surveying crew backed up by RCMP and bylaw officers.
This is for the Bear Mountain development that they're trying to punch through this provincial or taxpayer-funded highway to service the expansion of this huge enterprise up in the Highlands area.
Right, and now they're going to evict all these people.
Happy birthday to the end of the world. You're all grown up.
Yeah.
To the end of the world.
CFUV 101.9 FM, 104.3 on the cable dial, and CFUV.uvic.ca everywhere else on the internet and Shoutcast. Another new disc that I found here at CFUV. This is great. We get all this. I mean, these guys look pretty cool. The name of the band is The Burning Hell, and that was the title track from their disc, Happy Birthday. Which, that's the fun thing about radio. We get all this free stuff. Well, not everything is all fun and games, of course. And, you know, the most essential part of living for any being on this planet is water. And that, it's amazing to me, Canada treats its water in such deplorable fashion. Did you know millions of gallons of fresh water are fouled every day, fouled beyond reclamation by industry, especially the oil industry? That's oil that's not going to come back. Well, as well as removing this water from the hydrological cycle, we also interfere with the natural course of waterways with dam works, routinely destroy wetlands, we continue to log trees in the watersheds, and we fill in delta lands for housing developments, and all this comes at an incalculable cost to the natural environment and its wild inhabitants. Now, Eloise Charest Bertrand is a longtime peace, justice, and environment activist. She's traveled the world doing good works in dangerous environments, but it is only here in her native Canada where her efforts for the common good of people and the land rewarded with prison time. Well, welcome to the program, Eloise.
Oh, it's an honor to be on your program.
Well, it's my great pleasure, of course. Now, Eloise, we city folk, like me, we don't hear a lot about what's going on in BC's so-called heartland. Why is it then, Eloise, did you spend last summer and most of the fall sitting on a logging road outside of Nelson?
Well, it all started with friends of mine who were totally concerned about their ranch and were going to be affected. And we've been doing things up in the Duncan for years, trying to stop the herbicide spraying and the clear cuts, and have been successful at it in saving watersheds and whatever we could. But all of a sudden, this hydro went from micro hydro to macro hydro, and it's going to be one of the biggest projects, and it's affecting three drainages. So their road was already compromised because of the glacier melt off and everything in the spring. The land has been so disturbed by logging, it's unbelievable, and all the clear cuts melt at once, and the stream has already changed the direction, as well as the trout and whatever other fish that have been affected by all the siltation and everything.
It was an
honor to go up and help bring attention to Glacier Creek. And on top of the logging of old growth, and then this hydro project, right behind it is Jumbo, a resort for the wealthy, in a sense, to golf in the alpine and go skiing and flush their toilets with glacier water when the world is dying of thirst. And it's just too much.
Well, this is amazing, and this is part, I expect, of the ironically named free run of the river project that the British Columbia government put into place, which basically is a gold rush, an open season for people to go and claim water courses to put so-called green energy in the form of dams, micro and macro, along it. Well, now, Eloise, I understand that you've got some friends with you tonight.
Absolutely. And it's Mick and Gabriella Gabrowski, and they're the ranch owners who, they have a small little plot of land up there with their horses and everything. And they're, like many others, Gordon Planadin of Glacier, of Cascade Creek, and Tom Rankin, they're the very first people who are affected by it, whose land and life will be totally disturbed.
Well, Mick and Gabriella, if you're on the line now, tell me a little bit about yourself. Are you guys from the Nelson area, or did you move there to find a more rural way of life?
Well, I moved up to the Kootenays in 1981.
Could you speak up? Could you speak up just a little bit, please, Gabriella?
I moved up to the Kootenays in 1981. I used to live in White Rock, and I basically wanted to go to a place with clean air and clean water and green trees. And I just loved this place, and our land was a clear cut. It was a one-time mining claim, and in 1993 we moved onto it. It was just raw land. So we've created a ranch out there, and now they want to put a dam up above me. I live at about 15 kilometer, and they want a dam up above me at 23 and put a 7-kilometer tunnel through the mountain.
Oh.
And altogether, I think with Glacier Hauser Power, they want to put about 17 kilometers of dam, and what was supposed to be a 16-megawatt project when they started, just the micro hydro, is now 125 megawatts since Purcell Green Power has come on board, and this is some numbered company from Quebec, and we don't even know who they are.
Well, now, Mick, how did they get away, how did Purcell get away with this? I mean, they opened with a very small claim, and they did. Is there an environmental assessment that goes along with these micro claims? And do they have to get a second assessment if they're going to enlarge it?
There is an environmental assessment. I have no idea. They just seem to keep changing the numbers when they please.
What about the other people in the region? Is there opposition to this? Beyond yourself, of course.
It seems pretty much that there is opposition to it. But there's also people that are for it.
Well, now, Eloise, who would support something that sounds as destructive as Gabriella outlines? You know, with the
but it's again this false front, this double talk of calling themselves green. And what happens is that basically a little guy, whatever, comes by and he takes his claim on the water, and then from there. He proceeds, and what happens is that there's corporations right behind them, and it's like, hey, you can do better, you can make more, at the cost of creating a project at $6 per kilowatt hour. They will resell it to BC Hydro for $100 per kilowatt hour.
Well, good work if you can get it.
Which means it's a license to print money. And it's, instead of green, it's really greed, you know. And what happens is it's not only this project, but it's another 500. And behind them, again, major corporations talking about how they care for the environment. We need more electricity. And yet, it's going to go, the resort, or go down to the States? And instead of, you know, putting a windmill on your house or a solar panel and encouraging the people to become more independent, they're claiming every source, every waterway, everything. It's like Glacier Creek is a river. It's not a creek. And, you know, they're going to take, close to 80% of the water out.
Oh.
And it will not return into the creek. It goes through the tunnel and then comes out in the Duncan.
Man, that's something else. Well, what about the wildlife now? I mean, you've got these, it's often said that Canada has a fantastic percentage of the world's fresh water, and yet all that water has a purpose, and it crosses millions of square kilometers of land that needs the water and the animals on it. What about the wildlife up there? Has there been an assessment of what kind of effect reducing the water flows to such an extreme is going to have on the wildlife?
As far as I know, all they've been doing is measuring water levels. I mean, we see water shrews, which are unique little animals, and they fly up and down. What they did to count the Harlequin ducks on their study and their terms of reference was fly up and down with a helicopter. Like, you know, I've been trying to get their results, but it's really difficult to find out what they actually found out, and I don't really think they care.
Well, I do know that there is some, they have taken some effort in dealing with how the grizzly bears might be affected by all this, and what they've done is, many people may not be aware that the moratorium on grizzly bear hunting is a thing of the past. That was Gordon Campbell's very first act, as I recall, in coming into government here, was to lift that moratorium, and now they've increased the number of grizzlies that can be shot in your areas. Am I getting this right?
Yeah, I heard that myself, and I think they just want to get rid of the problems. That way they can go out and take their 100 kilometers of old-growth forest and put their power lines through it. It was an old-growth reserve on the far side of Hauser. My friend Tom Pryor put a movie on YouTube called Hauser in Peril, and Hauser is going to be hooked up with this Glacier Creek Power Project, and it's got just incredible old-growth up there, and they want to put this power line through that. And then still go up to Jumbo, and, you know, the grizzly bears, they haven't got a chance.
Well, of course, that means access roads and everything else. I mean, everything that's done in the wilderness in British Columbia, you need a road to get to it, which has which leads to a whole nother situation with the environmental degradation and more human interference in the wild areas as well.
Absolutely, and up there they have some of the largest of grizzly bears, incredible sizes and everything, because they've been in old growth, they've been isolated, they've been well fed, and they put out 34 grizzly bear tags in that area because of Jumbo, because of this hydro. And there's the biologists have only counted 32. So as Mick says, some bears will have to be shot twice. It's like crazy. We're watching the last of anything of nature.
Okay, well,
last of our sources.
The water is sacred to us. It's sacred to many people, you know. And when we stood up, we had a peace camp for a while, basically just trying to raise awareness because this was getting bigger and bigger and nobody was paying attention. And we're saying, hey, you know, it's not just a mom and pop operation. This is getting the big boys in here. And so we wanted to make people aware, and we had this peace camp, and most of the people came and signed our petition. And you know, we stopped people hiking up to Jumbo because the road was closed anyway. So we just closed it to vehicles. We said you can take a bicycle or you can walk up. And we made the technicians actually walk up to people during the study or take their bicycles, because I figure if you're going to deplete 13 kilometers of its water, you should see how far that is. And you think how the rocks are going to bake in the summer when the water isn't there to cool them. And the trees are going to be all dehydrated because there's drought and they need that moisture from the rock. You know, the mountain mist is not going to be there anymore if they take the river away.
Well, if you've just tuned in, you're listening to Guerrilla Radio on CFUV 101.9 FM, 104.3 on the cable, and CFUV.uvic.ca everywhere else. I'm speaking tonight with Eloise Charest, Bear Clan, and her friends Mick and Gabriella. I'm sorry, they've lost the Gabronski, perhaps. And they are living in and around the Duncan, not the Duncan on the island here, but Duncan near Nelson in the interior. And Eloise, you said that we need electricity, and this seems to be a common enough thing, not just us, but everybody. But is there any indication that the electricity that will be generated from these hundreds, 500 and more micro, macro, and everything in between hydro proposals, is there any indication that that electricity is actually going to be used in British Columbia, or will it end up maybe along the North American electricity grid, fueling the lights of Las Vegas or some other thing?
Oh, absolutely, because that's the way life is. Instead of, you know, your 100-mile diet or doing things locally and trying to sustain yourself, we're transporting food from all over the world, burning up fossil fuels and everything. And it will be the same with electricity. It will be exported. We already have enough electricity for BC, but, you know, with the big boys and everything, they're crossing borders under these new WTO, NAFTA, whatever group is meeting, you know. They've opened everything far and wide, and it'll be to the highest bidder. Like in Quebec, the people of the states were paying cheaper for electricity than they were in Quebec. And it'll be the same, you know, and it's also an issue of control. It's an issue of profit. And right now we're seeing the last of our sources, the last of our old growth trees, of our bears and fish and birds and indigenous people and people who care for the earth, you know. And this consciousness assumes that it can manage the earth, that it has a supervisor attitude instead of being part of the web of life. And it has a sense of being territorial, of owning, and that's why the crown's for sale. Everything's being liquidated right now before the treaties come into play. And it's, again, back to this consciousness, you know, sell, business, profit. And we can no longer afford it as a people if ever we're to live a living legacy for the future children.
Yeah, well, you know, we've seen this in Alberta in the tar sands too, where friends, acquaintances of mine who have worked up there say that they've never seen anything like it, that it's three shifts going 24/7 and at a mad pace as if there's no tomorrow. And it seems that that's a disease that has spread to British Columbia as well, this unmitigated drive to exploit everything that is left to exploit before the second coming or whatever it is that these people who rule us believe
in. Well, it's just the gold rush. You know, I haven't read John Calvert's book, Liquid Gold, but apparently that puts this whole thing in perspective of where, the money's going. So I guess he's a professor at Simon Fraser, so, I would recommend having a look at his book to put everybody in the picture.
And it's a gold rush. I think this is, if you look around the world, it's happening around the world. It's everywhere is being mined, hydropower, energy, dams going up. People of India have been fighting for dams and had some success. We're watching the whole world going down. We're watching this sort of almost corporate control of all life, on Earth.
Yeah, well, it is disheartening, but I mean, people have to get together. And now, Eloise, you have a website that outlines, and I was reading it the other day, and it's incredible all of the work you've done all over the world, and that you've come, and it's our great privilege that you've decided to make British Columbia your home and to devote your energies to some of the very serious problems we face here. Now, you have a website, eloisecharet.ca, that's Eloise. Charet.ca, Eloise Charet. How else, what other ways, Eloise, do people have of finding out more about the situation in your area and in the greater province?
Well, there's the Run of the River Society. It has a website. Ours is the Glacier Creek, but linking up. Each person affected, each area, like Gordon Planet in Cascade Creek, has a site that you can visit. And there's this larger Google map, and on it you can find all the rivers and creeks and that are affected, and find out the area. And like our website deals a lot with Glacier Creek, but links us with the other websites. And in Save Our Rivers Society, we post things, the latest news, and it's for the whole of BC. There's hydrofacts, I think, .car.com. And there's many, many groups that are involved in this right now. But like I say, it's there's projects going on everywhere. There's mining here like crazy.
Oh, geez, yeah.
No less than what's going on up north. Since they handed Nunavut back, they only gave the top inch of soil, and they've been absolutely blasting, drilling, and digging it ever since. And we can't continue at this pace.
Well, Eloise, we can't continue right now, I'm afraid, because we're right out of time. But but thanks a lot for coming on, both you, Eloise Charet, Bear Clan, and Mick, and Gabriella. And I also want to thank John Steinman for coming on, and Janine, of course, and everybody else that helps get things going. And I wish you guys all the luck. Again, eloisecharet.ca. Thanks a lot for coming on, guys.
Thank you. Thank you very much for having us. Well, it's an honor, as I said.
It's my great pleasure, of course. Well, that's all the time I got for you for this week. But hey, jazz fans, you're in for good news, because Arnold's coming straight up with Rhythmining. So I'll jazz you into this frosty late winter evening here in Victoria, British Columbia. And I'll play myself out again with another clip from The Burning Hell, from their disc Happy Birthday. And this one is called General Electric versus the Imperial Mob.
Off the highway.
Until next time.
Behind the liquor store. There's an Imperial Moth. It's been only 4 days since he's got his wings, but he flies like he owns the sky. Now he takes off from the pine tree store to see what
what's happening.